Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Before we get going, this is a second part of our massive deep dive, which came to almost 3 hours on the 1987 Rugby World Cup final. If you haven't listened to the first part, please go listen to that. That's up separately elsewhere. Please go and listen to that, because otherwise the rest of this won't make any sense. If you have listened to that already, then perfect. Thank you. And please enjoy the rest of this very delightful final episode of the 1987 series podcast.
Do you want to go to rugby heaven? Let's go back to 1987 with Squidge. With Squidge, let's go back to 87 with Squidge.
There's a point where New Zealand run a move. It was Kirk passes to Kerwin, who then tries to just loop the ball around somebody's head and offload it back to Kirk on the blind side. And yes. Keith says on the comms that that's the move with the dirty French word as the code name.
Yes.
So, yeah. Merde ball, I presume? Just thought it was really interesting. It's a bit more creative than Lefto or Righto or 89, but yeah. Just thought it was interesting, worth pointing out.
It could be condom.
It could be condom.
At one point during a line-out, New Zealand do just call, condom, condom, because they've guessed who it's going to. But it's funny, isn't it? It's funny that they just shout condom over and over again.
Yeah, because it's a word.
It's a good bit. Yeah. At one point you can hear Grant Fox on the mic shouting, it's going to Champ, and Eric Champ immediately just tries to, like, budge Michael Jones out the way so he can get the ball in contest and now he knows what's happening. And Jones steals it because Champ is too focused on trying to take his opposite man out.
And you know what? Like, I have no problem with that. Like, that's just pure shithousery to almost a detrimental extent. But who cares? You're under his skin now. Don't you worry, champ.
All over.
Yeah.
Or chomp.
Also, you mention Grant Fox. Like, once you notice him, like, being vocal, you can hear his voice all day long on the ref mic.
Mm.
And, like, he is extremely vocal. And again, he's a World Cup winning fly half. What do you expect? But also, like, once you get a kind of a knack for it when you're watching this game, you kind of realise, like, oh no, he's being a real control freak at this point. And I love that.
Mm. Mm. Yeah,
really commanding.
Yeah. There's at one point, there's a close-up of him and you can clearly hear the word drive come out of his mouth.
Drive, yeah. Yeah, which is great. And you just love, like, unfortunately. Because I was really looking forward to that. Because, like, there's a real intensity in the way he says it. And, oh.
Yeah.
There's a moment around this point.
Oh, yeah. Even in 1987, man. It's great.
Yep.
It's great. They should do this more.
These two, anyway.
They should play more games in 1987. And the other thing we didn't mention beforehand, right? The last game between these two, France had won. The last time these two teams played, about 2 years earlier, France had won.
Blimey.
Like, there was pressure on New Zealand. Like, this was kind of their bogey team even back then, and it always kind of has been throughout the history of New Zealand rugby. Like, France are the team they almost fear most because of the team that will upset them out of nowhere. Whereas Australia, the rivals, South Africa are kind of rivals for a different reason. France are the team that every now and again, they're the monkey. They're the monkey just lives on their back, or the chicken, as it were, that lives on their back. The Jean Chicken.
There's a point where on the comms they say the only thing that's going to be predictable about France today is the unpredictability in their play. And it was just like, oh my God, you've just coined so many cliches that we're going to use on the BBC in the next 5 years.
Know which team's going to turn up?
No, not a clue. But I've not heard that said once in the punditry of this tournament. And I'm delighted with that.
There's a moment as well in the game, to get back to it, of Grant Fox, because we're just talking about him, and it happens around the point we were at, the sheer speed of thought of that man is so far ahead of everyone else here.
He's fantastic.
One of the things that you talk about when you talk about a player like George Ford, Paolo Garbisi, like a lot of modern tens, like like I'm talking really modern tens rather than just tens who are playing nowadays. Like, this isn't necessarily true, but it is to a certain extent of someone like Dan Bigger or Andre Pollard or whoever.
Yeah. But you're right, new but young tens who have grown up in this version of rugby.
Exactly, exactly. Who've kind of come through a very different system and very different ideas and approaches to the game. Roman Untermack, you know, another example. Like, there's plenty of them out there.
Jalibert, yeah.
A lot of them, you know, continue coming through. Jalibert, brilliant one, yeah. And there's a moment where the ball is knocked on and Grant Fox immediately scoops it up and pings it into the corner. And the sheer speed of thought of him doing that and seeing that, and also, like,
I made
putting
a noise.
It shallow enough that if the winger was close, if the winger was holding his width, rather, Green would have scored. It's beautiful and so it's fast to the point at which he has clearly, whilst defending, identified the space behind in case of
mistake.
Like, he hasn't looked up in between.
He just gaps the ball
and instantly does the kick.
He anticipates the game so much better than any of the 10 in the whole tournament, including Michael Liner, actually, because he puts in a kick. Yes, indeed. He puts in a kick and thinks, what if this kick goes wrong? What if this doesn't bounce into touch? And then he'll cover the ground of where they're going to kick it back to or tell somebody else to. And he's so insanely smart in the way he anticipates the game. Yeah, he's unbelievable once again, Grant Fox.
Yeah, he is the finest rugby brain in this tournament by a long distance.
Such a long distance. So, like, speaking of Grant Fox, New Zealand are given a free kick 5 metres out from the French try line. It's probably 15 metres away from the touchline. And Grant Fox is stood on the 22-metre line, maybe two steps further back than that. And it's clearly something they've pre-planned. He says to David Kirk, just pull it all the way back, okay? Because as the rule is, with a free kick or a penalty, if you're going to take a quick tap, you can't take it forward from the mark, left or right from the mark. You can take it backwards from the mark. Mm. And so he tells them, just come back 20 metres, mate. And they go back 20 metres, and the pass from Kirk to Fox is 2 yards, maybe?
If that.
It's so small. And obviously back then, you were allowed... You were allowed to go for a drop goal straight from a free kick at that point. That's obviously been banned since. And they do. You're right. It's a pop pass, just meaning that the French defence have to start on the try line because that's where the back five, back 10 from the mark of the penalty is. And so Fox gets a free shot at the goal from 20 yards away and obviously absolutely nails it. It's a brilliant kick.
Yeah.
And it's just so well organised by the All Blacks generally.
It's unbelievably training ground. Like, it's the most of any goal kick you see, any attempt at 3 points you'll ever see in rugby, one of the safest bets. Certainly the safest bets, not straight in front of the
Exactly.
Pass.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't feel like there's any pressure on him at all.
All it requires is the man having the skill to pop it over. That's the only thing it requires. Yeah.
When you see in a normal game, just any match, a kicker taking a shot at goal from the tee, right? Everyone's eyes are on them and that creates an automatic level of pressure.
Does, yeah.
That is not the case here. It feels like he's doing it on the training pitch because there's no French player within 20 metres of him.
Yeah.
You know, even the quickest player rushing up is still about 10 metres away by the time the ball's left his boot.
Yeah.
There's no pressure on him whatsoever and he's just hitting it normally as any scenario and you can see what's going to happen. You can guess what's going to happen from the setup. But you kind of, because initially the forward setup is a screen and that doesn't happen. They then just pop it to him and he knocks it over. Cool as you like, really, really calm. Grant Fox, very good at rugby. Kicks the ball a lot, though, doesn't he?
Yeah, I was going to say, there's a point. It was on the 2017 Lions tour in the third test. It was Jordy Barrett's test debut. There's a point, the referee just blew for half time. Jordy Barrett happened to have the ball in his hand. He was still on the wing. He was practically on the touchline, dead on halfway. And he just drop kicks the ball. And then as the TV cuts to the aerial view, you can see that he nails the drop goal. Because there is no level of any material pressure on him whatsoever. If he was in the exact same situation, where all of the opposition were in the exact same place, nobody's actually trying to charge him down, but the ball was actually in play, he probably would have missed that.
Yeah, exactly.
And that is exactly what you're saying. He's under no pressure whatsoever. And all it requires is just a small level of execution, which he has. And the All Blacks have prepared for that to just completely minimise the pressure from him. And they get the first three points ever to be scored in the Rugby World Cup final as a result. Valuable.
Yeah, about 15 minutes in. Very
and they deserved points, obviously.
Yeah. Then very, very shortly afterwards, they get awarded the penalty in the 22 as well from a similar situation. First penalty of the game, 18 minutes in.
Yeah.
Referee really reluctant to award anything but uncontestable balls for scrums.
Definitely.
So, We then, New Zealand, camped in the French 22. France tried to clear it. They don't really get very far. And New Zealand pull a really smart set move. And that set move is, right, previously, John Kerwin's been stopped. Let's try pulling a fullback into the line. So they run a little loop play. They then hit Matt Gallagher's dad entering the line.
Yep.
Who, frankly, passes a bit too early to Craig Green.
Yep.
Who they have covered well. Because, as you say, it's the fullback entering the lines to the undefendable thing. It's not if he gives another ball, because Craig Green is covered. Craig Green does a little step, goes inside, and you think, still, this could be a chance. This looks... It's the most dangerous attack of the game.
Certainly is.
And this whole first 20 minutes has been entirely in French territory.
Yeah.
Like, France have been holding out defending really well.
Yeah.
But they're still trapped in their own half. Like, yeah. I think the ball gets out of their half twice.
Certainly's got to give eventually, haven't they? You know, it's got to be knackering.
But somehow, France managed to scramble and get onto Craig Green. They grab him about 10 metres short of the line when it looked like he was going to go right through. I think it would have been Didier Cambabera managed to get kind of hands on him, kind of grabs him, drags him a bit, and he goes to throw a miracle ball over the top, hoping someone's wrapped around. Gallagher and Warwick Taylor are both trying to get round there. Neither of them are there in time. The ball bobbles over and goes straight into touch. France have a line out, and as they look to throw it, things start to get the air of maybe they're about to go very pear-shaped.
Yes, indeed. First and foremost, this is the first final on this retrospective that we have covered where somebody has selectively passed the ball into touch. I wonder if that'll happen again on a future series in the World Cup final. We'll see. But yes, I then have written in my notes, no way. No way is this the first ever try in the Rugby World Cup final. Because this All Blacks team is so brilliant and talented that they shouldn't have to resort to such bullshit tries as this. So, straight from the line out, Grant Fox.
Yeah,
what a player, by the way. What a player Grant Fox is. Before I say any of this, what a player he is. His drop goal attempt from this is absolutely dog shit.
No, it's charged down. It's charged down.
Is he charged down? Oh, thank God. Thank God. Jeez, I thought he meant to kick it like that. Okay, thank God it was charged down.
I thought that at first. Then I watched Grant Fox being interviewed, and I think he gives the charge down a little bit too much credit, because I think it would have missed anyway. It's not a great strike, but he says, basically, I made that decision after I'd caught the ball to go for the drop goal, because I realised I had time.
Right.
And he fancied going for it. And then it scraped off, and he was like, oh, it's one of the French Lucys. I'm not sure which one. It's Obani. It kind of hits... who has his hands in the air, it kind of scrags off him and goes in a ridiculous direction. But it's not a great drop goal attempt. It was missing anyway.
Yeah.
But it is charged down, so you know, well.
Bounces along the floor, and poor Patrice Legisquet has quite a difficult ball to pick up off his toes. There's bobbling around, like, because you would think, like, oh, just trap it with your foot or something, but actually, no, he's got John Kerwin breathing down his neck. It's much easier said than done.
When you see it in the slow motion angle of that, close-up angle of the ball, right? That is one of the most difficult rugby ball
it's horrid.
Things I've ever seen to pick up.
Yeah.
Because the ball isn't bouncing, it's spinning. Like, it's on its side, spinning in a circle. It's impossible to pick up without fumbling. Like, you kind of...
Yeah.
You
at high
can't.
Speed
like,
as well.
It's spinning like a...
Yeah.
Yeah, like a bottle. Like, when you spin a bottle on, you know, on a surface. Like, the ball spinning like
with
that.
With John Kerwin on you
bobbling.
As well. Yeah.
So he has no time whatsoever. He has...
A horrid
top
combination
try scorer,
of
scorer, one of the quickest players in the tournament, right?
Who's a big physical man as well. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like a taller guy than him. And he has one of the most difficult... It's not even a bounce. It's a spin you'll ever see a rugby ball. Like, you try spinning a ball on the ground and picking it up whilst running onto it. So obviously he fumbles it
obviously
forward,
he fumbles
and he
it.
Knocks
it
off from spinning it into bouncing. And suddenly that's so much easier to pick up.
Yeah. But still, half of New Zealand seem to fumble it. But fortunately, they all do it backwards, so it's fine.
Yes.
Until eventually, Michael Jones picks it up, and you think, oh, it's all good. I mean, he has got a three-man overlap here, but hopefully Blanco has him covered. And Jones doesn't pass it. And you think, like, oh, I expected like the All Blacks would have the guy who would pass it. And he bumps Blanco off, and it's like, oh, okay, even when they take the wrong options, they're still great, and they still score tries. Like, they are human, but...
And
yeah,
Michael
scores.
Jones, of course, great, great trivia answer here. Who scored the first try in the Rugby World Cup ever, Will?
Do you have to bring that up? It was a penalty try.
Who? I said who? The first try ever was a penalty try, correct. The second try in a Rugby World Cup ever was scored by Michael Jones. So he was the first human to ever score in a Rugby World Cup. And then he becomes the first human to ever score in a World Cup final. And as a cyborg, he intends to be the last.
Yes.
So, yeah. Fox knocks over the conversion, makes it 9-0 to New Zealand.
Yeah.
Which is weird because France are playing well. And yet, it doesn't feel unfair as a scoreline.
It's crazy that, isn't it? Because you can give France so much credit for the shit they're doing, and yet there is they're not even close to having something registered on the scoreboard. Like, that feels so distant, the thought of them scoring even a three-pointer.
Yeah, puts them 9-0 down. But, right, the great stat, they were 9-0 down in the semi-final, went on to win. And in that year, Six Nations, where they won a Grand Slam, they were 9-0 down at one point against England and Wales, and they were 10-0 down against Scotland. And they went on to win all those games on the way to a Grand Slam and World Cup.
They back themselves. Yeah.
They're a team who love a comeback. They're a second-half team, to use the old phrase. And so, this French team, completely unshaken by it, completely not fazed by being 9-0 down, still were backing themselves, and were kind of hoping they'd get over the kind of emotional shakes that Philippe Salah talked about, like that first half they just weren't focused. And they just kind of struggled to focus for the sheer emotion they were all feeling that was riding through their bodies.
With that in mind, can we talk about Bebezier's break?
Yes, please.
Where he sort of fakes a box kick and then literally ducks under Gary Whetton. His flailing arms, ducks under him and makes a line break. And then he slightly panics and then he refines his composure as he's running and times a pass brilliantly to De Bronca, who's up in support, and they get up into the 22. De Bronca then throws this really needless offload, which hits the floor, and he obviously knocks on. But the referee forgets that it's him who knocks it on and gives France the scrum anyway.
Yeah. We also have, around this period, I think it's just before that, France have not been in the game. They've not had much territory, right? But they have the ball around halfway. And they just do a simple hands down the line move, because it was 1987. And they give it to Philippe Sella, who throws a dummy. And all of a sudden, your brain goes, France are not only in the game, they're going to win this. And I went into knowing New Zealand win it. But the moment Philippe Sella throws a dummy, you're like, well, they can't lose this. He throws a dummy, ducks under one tackle, jinks around the next, and goes, just glides past the next one. He's just so good to watch, man. He's just absolutely glorious. And every time he's involved, you're like, oh, France could score this. France could score this.
Philippe Sella gets the ball probably about five or six times in the entire game. But every single time you go oh, well, he's basically the best player in the world.
Yeah. I mean, I did text you whilst I was watching that first half, just in all caps, give it to Sella.
You did.
Just give it. I was just screaming it. Because he's
good
unbelievably
tactics.
Great. He is
so balanced.
I think
he's just gorgeous to watch.
Next to Grant Fox, the best and most talented player on this field, I think he's better than Blanc.
There's no doubt.
He's the best will in the
world.
There's
no doubt.
Yeah. I think he's unbelievable as a talent. And there's a few times he gets the ball. He does another one in the 22 where he throws a dummy and just glides past someone. He has maybe the best dummy I've ever seen. He is utterly brilliant and breathtaking to watch always. I
Vintage.
Love him.
Yeah. No, he's utterly box office every single time he gets the ball. Literally, I could watch him play 1v1 rugby and I'd still fall for his dummies. He's unbelievable.
But that break you mentioned, results in France getting the scrum just a few metres out from the line. And they have a chance here. And as we said, every scrum, the French have been on top. They have been driving through them. They've had a dominant scrum. And this was in the era pretty much before scrum penalties, right? It wasn't the same as it is now, where dominance gives you a scrum penalty and hence 30 metres.
You say France have been dominating them, but fuck me. Ondots eats a man here. It's absurd the dominance they have here. And it's very clear from all of their body language, we're going for the pushover try here.
Yeah. So we have Bebezier pats Rodriguez, the number 8, on the back and starts running to do an 8-9 move. And Rodriguez is just no chance.
He just says, no, keep running, pal. This is not coming your way.
What's the French for piss off?
The referee holds his hand out for an advantage because New Zealand very clearly collapsed the scrum.
This is a clear penalty try. This is the clearest scrum penalty try you'll ever see. Because the ball is about to go over the line. They're like an inch out and New Zealand drop it and crumple so that they can't get over. I think this is the most clean-cut scrum penalty try I've ever seen in my life, possibly.
I agree with you. What I thought was happening, so he held his hand out, and sometimes you see that thing where a referee holds his hand out and you can see the referee thinking, this is probably a penalty try, but I kind of don't want to blow up for the advantage. So I'll let this play out. And then by the time they've actually had a couple of phases, the referee goes back and you think, like, if the scrum just asked for it, he probably would have gone under the sticks. But now he's actually had a minute to calm down. He's not going to give the penalty try. And that's what I thought was happening.
Mm. So, France, with the ball collapsed and being told to use it, you know, the ball was there at the back, playable, as I said, with the clearest collapsed scrum and penalty try you'll ever see in your life.
Cynical and... as I say, correct for the All Blacks to do because they were going over.
Yeah.
There's no yellow cards at this point. Correct thing to do.
Yeah. Would have gone back to 6-9, which is a very different game to the 9-0 eventually go in at half-time with.
Yep.
So they collapse a scrum. The ball is at the number 8's feet. And Bezier panics a pass away because Kirk gets right up in his face. Like, does a really good job of just, like, hurrying the pass. So it's kind of in the air and it takes a second out of Manel before he can play it on. And they go down the line. Seller has a moment where you think, like, oh, is he gonna? And he kind of hands it on to our friend Patrice, Lazzy's gay. And I screamed, don't do this. Because I knew the referee would not come back for advantage because he hadn't earlier in the game. He called advantage over, like, when they made about a meter and went to touch. Like, I knew this would be the chance gone. Because he pins his ears. He is, like, 15 meters in. On around the 15-meter line, and he starts sprinting for the corner about 10 meters out. He's mostly running
opposite John Kerwin, I will add.
Yeah.
And it's an uphill climb.
Screaming, don't do this, Lazuske. Do not do this. But he goes for it. And he blows it.
He gets dragged into touch by a bigger and quicker man.
Yeah.
And
yeah, he gets
that
to,
was
like,
kind of the way it was
out.
Always going to go.
Yeah. And he never really stood a chance.
And
like, it would have been
say,
one of the all-time great finishes if he pulled it off.
Yes. The referee then just says, oh yeah, that's advantage over. They'd had like three passes. It was a penalty advantage on a cynical thing. They'd
gone
out pretty much in line with where the penalty was given. And he decides that's not a sufficient advantage. Which is
for the
ludicrous.
Most cynical penalty try you'll see.
Yeah. That is genuinely absurd. That he didn't give that as a penalty, go back to the advantage or anything, let alone give us a penalty try.
And I know advantage was quite a new rule at this point. Like, it was kind of a controversial thing. Like, it had been played in some countries but not others.
Mm.
There's an infamous story that's worth looking up, and I don't remember it in detail over the top of my head. But the advantage rule was basically introduced because it was a law in England but not Scotland. And it was the last play of a Six Nations game, or Five Nations game as it was at the time. And because each nation had different laws and rules, and they kind of, you know, like, compiled them into international laws, and generally the international game was played with English laws. But there was some disagreement here. And basically, right, Scotland were like a metre out from the line, and they knocked the ball on. England regathered it and scored. Scotland, because they didn't play advantage, they just stopped whenever there was a knock-on or a penalty or anything.
Mm-hmm.
They started appealing, like, no, we knocked it on. It should be a scrum to England. You need to award a scrum against us, which is the only time you'll ever see that, the team cheering to not have the ball.
Yeah.
Because if that was given and there was no advantage played, they would have won the game. Or they would have been the last play and England would have had the ball, but they could have defended it and they could have, you know...
Sure.
But instead, England saying, no, we're playing with advantage. You know, surely we're playing with advantage laws. And they had not arranged this beforehand whether or not they played advantage. And it's the only time it came up in the game was the last play. And in the end, the referee gave the try because he was kind of like, well, what else can I do?
Yeah,
that
yeah.
That kind of kicked off, like, them establishing advantage law. And I think that was probably about 20 years before this, but it still wasn't in the level it was now. Like, there wasn't a unified... idea of advantage.
Yeah, like a standardised, yeah.
Yeah, and I also think it varied greatly between hemispheres as well, and we see that in the refereeing here as well, because there wasn't, like, super rugby coverage on Sky Sports at this time, you know?
No,
like, this
exactly.
This was the first tournament broadcast internationally. This was the first time you could really see New Zealand playing Australia and so on in this era, in the UK or in France.
And you could establish so styles Australian of playing referee. And reffing. Yeah.
Exactly. Like, it's very different, and you're far more able to kind of get a global feel for the game nowadays.
Yeah, and
like,
copy
if we want
each
to go
other,
and
you
watch
know?
The Georgian League, we can now, right? Mm. Whereas you couldn't watch a test match between the two best teams in the world back in 87 from the UK.
100%. Yeah.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Then, so just to carry on, there's a point where France on the counter-attack go to feed the ball into Cambaro's hands, and Blanco releases the ball. Craig Green does what is a very obvious deliberate knock-on, sends the ball absolutely miles. I don't know to what extent this was an accepted law at this point, given everything we've just said, but he sends the ball flying, like sort of in the tackle, and it's one of those where the ball is released, it's going to go pretty much completely laterally, but it ends up flying about 20 metres behind Blanco's back because of the ball being slapped so far. And Earl Curtin on the commentary says, oh, I don't think that was a knock-on. I think that's just a really poor pass by Blanco. It's like, no! Yeah.
He's thrown it 20 metres behind the man.
Yeah. Because that happens without somebody changing the trajectory of it massively.
Like, people that have never passed a rugby ball before can throw more accurately than that.
Yeah.
Never mind one of the all-time greats. Yeah, Craig Green would be very much in the sin bin nowadays, but that was not really a thing that seemed to be being played back then, which is fair enough. Fine. Like, it was given as a knock-on. But I wasn't expecting it to. I was expecting them to play on.
Yeah, yeah,
I was
half
expecting that to be, like, an all-black, like, at least 3 points down the end of the
fifth. Genuinely, I was thinking, like, oh, no, he's about to score here. That's going to get given. This is going to be bullshit. But no, at least they had the scrum given, you know. There's then a point where, so France get a turnover, and Babesia sends this massive kick downfield. And Craig Green, cool as you like under pressure, one-handed swoops down and scoops the ball up to Gallagher, who then clears the ball. And it's like, oh, that's really nice. Like, that's a scrum-half skill, scooping the ball at one hand, feeding it up. Mm. But very nice bit of skill by Craig Green. Great time to flex it in the World Cup final under pressure.
Okay. But here's the thing, right? You are missing one of my favourite parts of the game.
Right.
The moment for me that Pascal Ondarz became a legend.
Oh, yes.
Became an absolute hero.
Yeah, I know. I'm listening.
So, there is a moment where New Zealand have a penalty given to them. They are awarded the penalty at the breakdown for something or other that happened.
Yeah.
It just goes on. And Pascal Ondarz, for no reason whatsoever, kicks an All Black in the face.
Yeah. It's great because there was briefly the camera was on him and they start talking about, oh, this is Pascal Ondarz. He's never lost a test match before. And I thought, oh, okay.
Yeah.
That's big news.
10 out of 10.
Suddenly, as the camera is on him, you see him kicking Alan Wetted in the head. And it's just like, oh, okay.
But he's so casual about it, right?
Yeah.
It's my favourite thing about him, that he does this. There are 2 points in the game where he kicks an All Black forward in the head.
It's great because
and in both of them he is looking completely off and he is doing something else and none of his body language is saying I'm about to kick a man in the head.
He doesn't look angry whatsoever.
No.
He just was like it would be fine if I kicked an All Black in the head right now. And the first time he gets a dressing down from the referee and gets told don't do it again, and he does it again. That really specific thing he's told not to do.
And the second time, the referee calls him over and is like, mate, you just kicked someone in the head for the second time. Like, first time right in front of me, this time right in front of the touch judge. And he goes, I'm sorry. Mm. And the referee goes, okay, fair enough. I just let him play on. He's a hero. And I know maybe we shouldn't celebrate dirty play, right? But there's something about the blasé balls of the guy to just repeatedly kick players in the head and not care and also, just get away with it and not care if he's caught. I love the sheer balls of the guy.
Also, as well as him, there's a point where Daniel De Bronk kicks someone in the armpit. Which is so hilariously random, because it's just a not very vulnerable part of the body to kick. And it's so, again, it's so unangry, his kick. It's like, it's not like it's at all provoked. It's just like, they pushed Sean Fitzpatrick into touch. And then Daniel De Bronco just gets up and goes, you know what this guy needs? He needs a kick in the armpit, and gets penalized for it. And it's just, they're like, well, yeah, you're the captain. What do you want your team to do now if you're going around kicking men in the armpit? Daniel De Bronca was just so randomly wound up all game that I kind of enjoyed it. Like, he was just being an arsehole for the whole second half because he hated the fact he was losing, which is fair enough, heart on your sleeve and that. But it was very funny, like, the shit he was getting himself into for the second half.
Yeah. I want to add another thing on the Pascal on darts thing, right? Two points, right? One, Jason Leonard said Pascal on darts was the best, the toughest, and the hardest prop I ever played against, which...
High praise.
Yeah, I can see that.
Very high praise.
I see that.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was also named as number two on a list of the most frightening French players to ever play the game.
Who's number one?
I don't know who number one was. I don't know. But...
Yeah.
You know, not bad, not a bad place to be. And that was very much what he was remembered for. He went on to play until the 91 World Cup, where he was aged 35, then retired and opened a restaurant in Biarritz.
Oh, nice. Good for him.
Which we're going to have to go to at the World Cup. Surely. We've got to go to Pascal and Dart's restaurant.
See if we get kicked in the head while
we're out there. Yeah. Notoriously, incredibly, incredibly hard man.
Yeah, he seems nuts.
But the thing I love about this, right? Both penalties he gives away for kicking a man in the head, Grant Fox misses, and there is only two misses of the day.
Yeah.
So he goes completely unpunished for kicking two All Blacks in the head.
It's brilliant. Also, the first time he does it, when Grant Fox signals for goal, the crowd boo. It's like the World Cup final. He just wants points. They maybe knew he was going to miss. It was the issue.
And it'll put him... It put them 12-0 up, which is a pretty sizable lead, especially bloody in the 6 points for try days.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Also, can we address the Blanco filth that occurs straight after this missed penalty?
Oh, it's please
phenomenal.
Do. Please do.
He ushers to the sideline, like, signals the ball, like, I need a ball because I need to send this kickoff flying.
No, so before that, okay, yeah. So, great situation that I love, where the ball boys send on two balls, and both the players, it's the two halfbacks who have the balls, both then kick it off to use the other one.
I didn't notice that. That's fantastic. Yeah, then Blanco signals the sideline, like, give me a ball. The ball boy throws him a really shit pass that he picks up around his ankles. And again, while he's down there, he thinks, I might as well go here. And just drops
the
ball.
Yeah, he does this thing where he kind of, he's like, he turns his body as though he's about to pass it to Manel.
Yeah.
To kick off. Yeah. And then you say, while he's down there around his ankles.
Just kicks it off to himself.
Yeah.
It's glorious. And then he makes a break off the back of that. And they go sort of half the length of the field between him and Cambombolo.
Draws his man, gives it to Cambombolo, who then sticks it on the toe, puts it into the 22. And John Gallagher is under enormous pressure. Mm. And you think, like, best case scenario is he slices the kick here.
Yeah.
You know? Like, he's probably getting caught in his own 22 and he's under enormous pressure with the French team, like, rushing forward onto them. But he gets in an unbelievable kick.
He does. Yeah.
Like, one of the best clearance kicks of the tournament.
Yeah.
Somehow gets them up to halfway, saves the entire situation from what looked really, really dangerous from a moment of absolute genius by Serge Blanco
and then,
moments earlier.
Straight away, Blanco is down, injured. And realistically, it's what would happen if we all played against the All Blacks. We would be blowing after one run, you know, one defensive set or whatever, and he just needs to lie down. And there's the medics coming up to him saying, like, all right, what have you hurt? And you can see him making it up. Like, he just needs a breather. And you know what?
Yeah.
Well done to you, King.
Fair play. Like, fair play.
If any of us smoked as much as Serge Blanco to get through any rugby game is impressive, let alone against the All Blacks in the World Cup final. Good on you.
Well, Leslie Skay then recovers that ball and plays on a bit.
Yeah.
They spread it out to Cameron Barabero on the other wing, who has a bit of a chance but falls over.
Yeah, the sniper gets him.
Yeah. You know what? He still outplayed John Kerwin, so who cares? Yeah,
damn right he has. You also say that because there's a point where they spread it back to the other wing and Leslie Skay absolutely skins Kerwin on the outside of the pitch. He runs outside the touchline.
Yeah.
And then he's like, oh, mate, I've just done Kerwin. And then he just carries on running, like, I'd like to beat the football.
It's a proper, like,
touchdown flags up.
Marcus Smithy, like massive goose step, hitch kick round him.
Theatrical.
Get on the outside, doesn't realize he stepped over the touchline.
Yeah. And he's like a good 3 meters over the touchline. Like, he runs on the outside of the pitch, then back in. Like, oh, mate, no one's noticed that. Did anyone just see that? I've just beaten John Kerwin. I'm amazing. And then, oh, the touch judge saw that. It's the one person I needed to not see that.
We also have a beautiful kick by Denny Charvet, right? And I want to take a moment to talk about Denny Charvet.
Okay.
I don't know if you've also followed up and got anything on Denny Charvet.
Yeah. There's a piece of information I learned from him in the commentary in this game.
Yes. So, Denny Charvet, right, went into this tournament, like Glenn Ennis, an aspiring actor.
Yes, he wants to be a movie star, and he hoped that winning the Rugby World Cup would help open up some opportunities in the world of acting for him.
He very much hoped that if he could get a big moment in the final, that would be his gateway into the movies.
Like a viral clip
something. Basically, yeah, he was hoping, like, if he scored the winning try or he, like, gave an important pass or something, he could become a hero in France.
I see.
And therefore, that would open doors.
Yeah.
And that was kind of his game plan. And you know what?
I hope he said this on match day in that vulnerable moment.
In that, yeah, like, this was what he was like. He's like, I'm going to be a movie star, guys. Like, Jean-Luc Godard is going to watch this game and pull me out personally. When bloody Eric Champs working for Eric Roma, you know, like, he's going to put me in his films as well. But, right, in some ways, this World Cup did work for him.
Okay.
Because Denny Charvet went on to, 20 years later, direct a documentary that got a cinema release about the first World Cup.
That's what that was. I didn't realise he directed it.
He directed a documentary in the tournament that came out during the 2007 tournament.
One day we should get to that.
Yeah, I did have a brief look. I couldn't find it somewhere online, but I want to have a deeper look later because I only came across this like shortly before we started doing the podcast.
Look, it's that and The Kick about Stephen Donald in 2011. Yeah. They're the two films about the lore of this podcast that we need to get to.
But, like, also, he didn't exactly have, like, a glistening career as an actor, but he did get some work, like, later off this World Cup.
Yeah, like, I hadn't heard of any stuff he's all in French, as it happens.
Yeah, well, about 3 years after this World Cup, like, he starts getting work, he starts getting stuff, because he kind of, like, his rugby career kind of becomes less of the primary focus, I guess. After this, he continues playing for France until 1991. But it is around 1990 that he starts getting acting work and he kind of goes, well, I'll play for the World Cup and then I'll see if I can do this full time.
Yeah.
And he kind of calls it. He goes on to play another couple of games for the Barbars over the next few years where he basically, like, plays a bit for Stade and plays a bit for the Barbars, but, like, is mostly focused on trying to build this acting career at Dans de Paris. And, like, and he has some, you know, he does a film with Isabella Rossellini. He does a film with Vincent Landon, who's, like, pretty well-known, like, French and Italian actors. Like, he has a solid career through to his kind of big break. He produces a film called Druids in 2001, which stars Christophe Lambert and Max von Sydow, and is apparently was a reasonably big hit, which he's in. That was his biggest role, his biggest kind of, like, highest-grossing movie. He kind of, you know, did all right in that. But that movie marked kind of a shift towards him focusing on producing instead of acting. And he is now a producer who also works as a rugby pundit in France, which is probably where he pays the bills.
Yeah.
But it's a strange crossover,
you take it.
Yeah. You know, he's done all right. However, right, I want to read you a bit of his punditry and why perhaps he should be focusing on the producing instead.
Okay.
What is your opinion of Thomas Ramos and whether he should be in prison?
I think he is filthy in every possible sense of the word, Tomas Ramos. And yes, I think that there are several things he does in his own 22 which I would say are punishable by imprisonment.
Yes, I think he should be locked up, Tomas Ramos.
Through the legs.
I love to watch him
on his own 5 meter line
without knowing if there's anyone there, completely blind.
Yeah.
Do not do that. That tap he did against Wasps last year. Do not do that. You know, Tomas Ramos.
Nothing is recommended that you try it at home that he does.
I think I once said something like he seems like he's more focused on daydreaming about the try he's about to score than catching a high ball. You know.
Yeah.
And that kind of sums him up. Like, he's an incredibly talented player, but he's not trustworthy whatsoever.
I love him. I'd hate him if he was on my team.
Absolutely. Denny Charvet, this is his comments on Tomas Ramos recently, about 2 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
This guy, Ramos, never makes a mistake. He is impeccable, imperial even. He is effective every time. He's maybe the most trustworthy player in France.
Fuck off.
You have to win to lose. You have to win
France
to lose.
France is the country Roman Untermat lives in.
Yep. By scoring a try at the end of the match. Every time he passes at the opening, meaning there's fly half, he is excellent. The guy exudes ease. Everything comes to him so cleanly, so easily, so well. I just trust him immensely. I think this boy deserves more attention, more respect.
Trust.
Last year, he was already in very good shape. And last year, and kicking. He's amazing. Look at his kicking. That is what
Tomas Ramos,
Denny Chavez,
is. Tomas Ramos is a properly world-class talent. I would say a lot of brilliant things about him, but all the complete opposite of what Denny Chavez says there. I think he is a complete maverick. He is mental. And that is why he is such a brilliant rugby player, because he's so unpredictable. He is not trustworthy in the slightest.
Which Charvet says 3 times. Maybe the most trustworthy player in France.
He's been paid off for that.
Thanks, Denny Charvet.
Thank you, Denny Charvet.
Yeah, yeah.
Good luck with
Denny
your
Charvet,
film production.
Tomas Ramos, really wants him to produce a movie about him. He's daydreaming about it already.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
We've got to half-time, I would say.
He also... No, Denny Chavez, one more fact about him, right? His last role as an actor before retiring was in 2013 in a film called Viva La France, where he played a drunk, angry rugby fan.
Oh.
Which is quite meta, in a way.
Yeah, yeah.
The role is listed in the credits as rugbyman.
I'm sure he did really, really well on that role.
Yeah, I'm sure he absolutely nailed it.
I would hope.
Like,
he probably should have...
A big moment, like the final.
He probably should have cast his mate Daniel De Bronca to play that role, but hey, that's fine. I can't blame him for giving it to himself, so.
Though, right, you may have missed this, he's also written a novel.
No.
He wrote a novel. I can't find out what it's called, or I did, but I lost it, and I can't find it again. It was a book about a sports person who retires and really struggles to adapt to normal life because they're so used to the kind of, like, people cheering and chanting and sharing their names and loving them. And he talked about how hard that was, and so he wrote a book about it.
Fair enough.
It somehow got published, so maybe it's good.
I thought you were going to say a sports person who retires and struggles to become an actor. I was going to say. Like, that appeals
about,
to a lot of people, and not Glenn Ennis.
It's about dealing with that kind of, like, come down after you've been involved.
That
and the article
like
I read
right
about his
concept
book,
for a book
and talking about him was almost entirely about how good-looking he was. It mentions over and over again in the opening paragraph, he is the most handsome man alive. They call him about 3 times rugby's 007 because he's so handsome and suave.
I think he wrote it about his mate Patrice Lebon.
I was going to say, between him and Patrice Lebon, a man who is so handsome he isn't real, that you really feel like there's a lot of like depth in the handsome centres charts in France. Mm.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that, you know, you do wonder who he possibly could have based that on, but then again Dave Cherry hadn't started playing yet, so I don't know. There's a man comfortable in his baldness, Dave Cherry.
Abso-bloody-exactly.
So we hit half time.
Where were we? Yes.
Second half starts. I'm aware we're 2 hours into this podcast, but it is also the final. So
yes, we are, okay.
Serge Blanco puts up a really good bomb, start the half. Taylor drops it, and you think, oh, they could score here. And once again, they just can't get anything out of their good attacks, France. It's really, it's difficult. There's a point where Blanco does this lovely pickup and passes it straight onto Karen Barombero, who chips over and think, oh, we could score here. But again, Kerwin just beats him to it. And it's like, they can't catch a break.
There is one attack I kind of want to mention. I've just realised, I thought it was at the start of the second half. It's actually the end of the first half.
Sure.
But I think it's actually really, really interesting. Firstly, right, it happens because Kirk puts for a beautiful kick, like a really, really nice ball.
Yes.
Kick. Like you say, cannot cover it. And Blanco absolutely bollocks him for it. And like, even when the lineout is happening and they're trying to throw it in, Blanco is still like saying things and turning and facing Lackey's gate to like bollock him for not having taken it on the full, not having covered the kick and dealt with it. But instead, yeah, it puts him under enormous pressure, right? And this leads us into, this is the attack where I think it's cleanest that you can see something the All Blacks were doing in this World Cup that we haven't been able to talk about and I haven't really got into, even though it's something I read about and heard about and was looking for examples. And this is the cleanest example you can find, partly because I'm looking at it in a far more analytical way. But also, I think it just happens, and it happens because France have the highest quality defence they've come up against in this tournament by some distance. Because, you know, the semi-final, the second most intense game they played, was against bloody Wales. But New Zealand were running a precursor to the 1-3-3-1 and pod systems.
Right.
They were running like a really, really rudimentary version of this, where they split their forwards into two groups of four.
Oh, wow.
And so four players would focus on rucks on one side and four in the next.
That's extremely advanced.
Separately. Yeah. And we have like, there's like 4 points in this game where Sean Fitzpatrick gets the ball on the wing.
Mm.
And that's because he was part of the system of having two separate groups of forwards.
I did notice that he got carried into touch twice.
Yeah,
because he stood on the wing.
Yeah. So it basically, they accidentally invented the edge forward there. That wasn't a deliberate part of the group.
Yeah.
The thing. But they were splitting their forwards into two groups. They were usually four and four, but sometimes like 5 and 3 or something. So this was like an early version of that. And you can quite clearly see it if you're looking for it in the end of the first half. And also, Grant Fox does a thing where he drops off a pass to Warwick Taylor taking a short ball. And he loops around to attack the next phase. Like clearly looking for that. Which is really ahead of his time as well. Like, he's clearly looking at that before he's dropped the first pass off. Whereas at the time, it was just like, you attacked what was in front of you rather than thinking ahead. And so you see two moments of the All Blacks being hugely ahead of their time in that last play. And it doesn't lead to anything. They get put into touch. But, like, you can really clearly see four of the forwards clear out, and they end up going blindside instead of the side Fox was looking for. But then those forwards carry, and you have the four forwards there then to clear out and hit each other. But you also have a point in the second half where France run a tip online. There's someone running off Eric Schomp. So we do have a few moments of just like things that will become innovations in 20 years time just naturally occurring.
Just because these are the best teams in the world, they can see the space and something, you know, naturally, which eventually becomes planned, right?
Yeah. But that 4 and 4 thing and like splitting their forwards up was a tactic in New Zealand.
That's
like that
crazy.
Was something they talked through. Like real early predecessor
insane.
To the pod system and the 1-3-3-1 and so
they
on,
run a 4-4
happening 30 years early.
Wow.
30 years earlier.
And like that's a legitimate structure to play these days, you know? It's not very good compared to, you know, 1-3-3-1, 2-4-2, whatever.
Sure.
But it is one. And it makes sense at this kind of level where the forwards have a lot of running to do, and as I say in the amateur days they won't be as fit. Running a 4-4 is a better way of conserving your energy. That's fantastic that's run. That's a long, long time.
Georgia were running that this year, you know?
Yeah.
Georgia ran a 4-4 this year.
Yeah. I've seen Ireland in the last year running, and South Africa as well, running a 3-3-3 with the inside centre being the ninth forward. It's not so insanely far-fetched.
No. Like, it's a crazy thing to be happening this far out. Yeah. And it just shows how good this New Zealand team were.
Definitely, definitely. That's brilliant. That's a fantastic spot. Well done.
Thank you. I should make a job out of this.
Yeah, you should. Karen Barombero gets a penalty.
Yes.
It becomes 9-3, and it's like, oh, finally, they're on the board. And the rain starts tipping down at that point, and you start to think like, oh, is this going to suit France? But then you remember like, no, because Grant Fox is kicking really well. So,
yeah, and I mean, like, we also see a wide shot of the stadium, and we see that the first ever Rugby World Cup final is being played in front of a rainbow.
Which is cool.
Which is kind of beautiful, and also the most that World Rugby's ever done for LGBT rights within rugby. And I'm surprised they're not, I'd be really surprised if they don't bring that up
unless,
at some point. It's like, look, we once played in front of a rainbow.
Unless the B in that stands for bald.
Yes, they've done an awful lot for bald
rights. Awful lots of, for bald people.
You know what? Really proud of Maxime Lucu for being so upfront about it.
Absolutely. Grant Fox then hits back with a penalty like immediately afterwards because France's backs are all offside at them all. And it's just like, oh, what's the point in this? 12-3 at that
point. And like, That penalty, the Foxes one is really easy, whereas Camembert-Berry like nails it on the angle on the 22-meter line, like right on the touchline, like really difficult kick, a lot of tension on it. They give the anecdote about his hair. You see the confidence flowing through his body, and then immediately New Zealand get a really easy shot and reply.
Yeah. Very, very
but by that point, the rain is tipping it down. Mm. And the rain doesn't last that long, but like it is heavy for the 10 minutes it's there.
Yeah.
Not even that, probably 5 minutes it's there.
Also, by the way, I forgot to mention earlier, you know what, on the return of the rooster, when he comes back on the field?
Yes.
Keith Quinn says, well, it might be Coco Van on the menu tonight.
That's upsetting.
That's what he says.
They wouldn't say we're going to eat dog, are they?
No, exactly. And it doesn't mean cock in the back of a van. There's a joke.
Thank you.
Grant Fox gets another penalty. I didn't even note down what it's for, but 15-3. Oh, no, that's for kicking him out of the head. Right?
Yeah, okay. Tell you what, right? There's a moment in which France kick long. Actually, no, I think it might be a mistrial goal. I've not jotted that bit yet.
Sure.
But, right, Matt Gallagher's dad takes the ball just before the goal line, dots it down, carries it back, should have given a scrum five to France. Mm. The 22 is given.
Controversial, that was.
Yeah. Bloody TMO needs to step in retroactively.
That would have been TMO.
I've seen TMO reviews that were further back. But they could do it now.
Yeah.
I've seen referees going to the TMO for things that happened further back than 35 years.
Yeah.
You know, they could do it now.
It's valid. You'd think, though, this referee would still be checking it today. So, you know, kind of gratefully just go on with it. Decision unplayable. Let's have a scrum.
Then the All Blacks get downfield, and they, one of those things that happened here, right? Well, they just took it out the winger, does a chip kick, and that's good attack.
Yes.
And you know what it was?
Yeah.
But Green puts through a kick, and Blanco is nowhere to be seen, has to absolutely pelt it across, and then pelt the ball into touch on that.
Oh, yeah. He sends it fucking miles.
Yeah.
It's great.
It's gone to join his imaginary ball.
I was going
to
say, it landed on the other side of the rainbow.
Hit the leprechaun on the way.
Yeah. There's a point where Kirk puts up a brilliant bomb for Blanco as well, and Kerwin just piles on the pressure and just sends him into touch. And again, like, that's when Kirk really starts growing into the game as well.
Yeah. Michael Jones had to try disallowed from the resulting line out for a knock on, where it could have been a second try in the World Cup final, but alas, not to be. Would that have made him the only man to score two tries in a World Cup final? Yes, it would. Yeah, it would.
No one's ever done that.
No, no one's ever done that.
That's mad.
Yeah.
Great stat.
Yeah. Would have been, but the try was disallowed.
Yeah.
So I suppose he's the only player to cross the try line with the ball twice in the World Cup final.
I guess so. But there is, however, a try not long afterwards. So the All Blacks attack blind. They're on sort of the 22-meter line. And then Grant Fox does this thing where he sort of pirouettes and pops the ball back inside to Jones. And it looks shit, if not for the fact that you know it's premeditated by Fox. And he knows that space is going to open up. And it looks like shit play, but actually he just has manipulated the French defence without even really trying. And Jones has a little run up against Blanco and managed to get an offload back inside. And it is David Kirk, the skipper, who, as I say, has just grown into the game, like put up a few like really good kicks in a row and has a really strong finish to carry a man over the try line with him. And the commentators make the point of, like, that's a proper, like, captain's finish. And I really agree with that. Like, it's, like, a leader standing up at the right moment. And, yeah, it's good by all three men involved.
So I listened to David Kirk talking about this try, talking about the moment, and saying the moment the most people talk to him about is the lifting of the World Cup, but the moment he remembers best in the game is his try.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, very, very fair.
Also, it's the point where you know they're going to win it.
Yeah. And because it is the moment where they finally break down that French defence has been on top of them for so long. You know, like, the first try is kind of a fluke. It's a lucky bounce. But the rest of the game, they've been, like, hounding them. Like, there's a moment not long before this where they get it out to Buck Shelford on the wing, who looks like he's got a good chance. It looks like he can finish this. And out of nowhere, Eric Schomp turns up with his curly hair and no muscles and just belts him into touch.
Yeah.
Like, it's a brilliant try-saving tackle. And you just have, like, these moments of individual French players stopping them with that clear, like, emotional energy they had powering them through here. And it's the moment where suddenly they can't keep up.
Yes.
And when Kirk talked about this try, he said there was one thing we did differently in the lead-up to this, right? Which is normally they positioned their two tallest men in the middle, and they put Michael Jones at the tail. And Michael Jones was basically, as Kirk referred to, he had an incredible spring on him. Like, he could jump like from standing start incredibly high and kind of bat the ball back. And they decided what we're going to do is we're going to swap Jones into the middle and we're going to move Weston out to the tail. And we're going to throw it to Jones. And France basically weren't expecting this. They thought, oh, they're putting it there because they're going to throw it to the tail. Because they put the tallest guy at the tail, and that makes sense. But instead, they threw it to Jones in the middle, who then does this, like, outleaps the guy, knocks it down. France are slightly slow to react because they're looking for the ball at the tail.
Yeah.
And it also means that the ball comes down into Kirk's hands really smoothly, and it means he can throw the pass very quickly. And even though it's quite a loopy pass, eventually, that he throws because he tries to get it away as quickly as possible, it buys him an extra second.
I see.
And it also allows the other All Blacks, including Jones himself, kind of especially Jones himself, to work around and to get into position to clear out the next ruck. And basically, Kirk says it was like us changing that line out from what we've been doing all game and what we're doing basically all World Cup is what scored us that try.
Wow.
Is that we did a different line-out call and it allowed us to get the forwards into position better because we were using a jumper rather than height. And it meant France had no chance of contesting because we were looking at who can jump the highest rather than who is the tallest.
That's really interesting as well.
Also by Nathan Fielder.
Great reference. That's a really interesting point because you again wonder if that's the precursor to Eddie Jones inventing the two-phase move like 10 years later.
Yeah. And it wasn't the, like...
having a knock-on effect the way you set up the line out.
Yeah. Like it wasn't... They weren't going, we need them to clear out the ruck. It was just like, we want them out of there to play away quickly.
Yeah.
And it meant that then when Taylor takes into contact, they can recycle. And if we look at every good attack in this tournament, or if we look at every good attack in this final, all of them seem to be coming, like basically every break in the game is coming from second or third phase. Every chance is coming from recycling the ball. And there's a point not long after this as well, where France pile like five forwards in and they almost turn the ball over. But Kirk managed to just about get it away in time, just before the ball is lost. And it leads to a very clean break because they've piled all the resources in. And it's the sort of thing teams are not coached to do nowadays, but like it would become a real consideration in about 10 years' time. And you're seeing the start of it here of like the tries that come and the breaks that are made are coming off multi-phase moves because defence in this final was good. And so they needed more effort and more to break them down, which is obviously the absolute backbone of rugby nowadays. But at this point, it was just beginning to, just the seed of that was starting. And it allows, Kirk plays it away on the blind side. Fox plays it, and then, as you say, plays the inside ball. And Jones flips it back inside, having been back on his
feet. Yeah, at that point, you have broken field. Yeah.
And you've got, as well, if you watch it back, four French forwards really hair it across outside once they see Fox going out and Jones inside. And it means no one is watching for the support line by David Kirk, which is excellent.
Yeah. It's a brilliant support line. I like the fact that you mentioned that like that's the iconic moment for him, because you can really tell, like as soon as he's gone over, he has like a moment of just like, that was good. Like we can win this now. We're going to win the World Cup. And like straight from the kickoff, Kirk's straight off again and has like a great sprint down the wing after one phase, literally, off the kickoff. And he has a great sprint down the wing. Quick ball recycled.
Yeah. Condom goes for him and he literally like ducks under him. It's great.
Yeah. And the ball's recycled super fast as he is tackled.
Well, it's the thing both we were saying to Paul the other week and that I've mentioned on previous episodes that France are now, the modern France team, are now doing again where you can replace the thing that happened with Fiji in the 70s as well, but you can replace a phase by just popping the ball off the ground, you know, just like hanging it in
exactly.
the air. And they do that to Buck Shelford, as you say. Or who Kirk picks? Does.
Yeah, and he picks the ball up off his toes and delivers a gorgeous pass to John Kerwin.
Yeah,
and
absolutely
steaming
onto the ball at full pace.
They've contained Kerwin all game, and you think like you've really feel for France.
That played him.
Yeah, he absolutely has. But they've done such a good job of keeping Kerwin quiet. And the fact that he, because he scores here, he goes on the outside and he dives in the corner, he bursts the corner flag once more.
Yeah.
Jamie Lyle would love it. But that happens and you think, wow, the fact that they've done such a good job of containing Kerwin and he still pops up and scores one in the final. Like, this All Blacks team are untouchable at this stage.
It's the Justin Marshall screaming, John Kerwin! Go, Johnny!
Yeah.
That's the World Cup! You know, it's that moment. It's that moment happening all over. Go, Johnny! Yeah, and Kerwin finishing it. Brilliant finish. And I'm so glad, as well as obviously David Kirk is kind of the focal point in this reinvented New Zealand team. He's kind of head boy aura getting a try. But I love that John Kerwin is the star player in this tournament. Got himself a try.
Absolutely. It's a shame Alan Wetton didn't get one. He scored in every other game.
Yeah. Ruined his record.
Yeah.
Where's the Felipe Contepomi record from the Heineken Cup now?
Right. Wetton did play very well.
He did.
And has
he
done
did.
All
Both
tournament.
Both played well.
Yeah. I mean, we're getting fairly towards the business end of this match, I think. But
so Fox knocks over the conversion and they cut to the crowd is all losing their mind, apart from the one woman most in focus who looks very confused.
I didn't see this.
Just very confused woman.
I wasn't sure if you were going to follow up on that.
No, of course I'm not. Of course I'm not.
Fox gets one more penalty and the All Blacks reach their final...
Mate, so that penalty, can we talk about what it's for?
I've forgotten. So, what was it?
A punch that doesn't happen.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The referee sees a punch and they show on the replay and there is just nothing of the sort.
There's no punch. There's an arm that swings slightly but doesn't connect with anyone or get near anyone. And the referee goes like, that was a punch. I'm putting you on a final warning and penalising you.
Yeah.
There was no punch.
And he points to someone and goes like, be careful, punches. I'm watching you. Yeah.
Like, there have been punches in this World Cup the referees have seen and gone, less of that, please, but not penalised. And he penalises a punch that doesn't even happen.
He's making up for lost time, isn't he?
He really is. He really, really is.
So, Fox brings up New Zealand's final points tally of 29, and they get to 29-3. Yeah. And there's a seagull invention! 1,000 seagulls come onto the pitch!
It's mad. This also follows like a beautiful 50-22 from Grant Fox that leads up the penalty.
That also happens.
That's great. There's also a nice chance with John Kerwin, who then offloads to Fitzpatrick, who gets put into touch.
He does, kind
of things. Yeah, and then bloody as he's lining up the kick, you see there's about 400 seagulls on the pitch.
Yeah,
there's just an absurd
all congregating
number of birds
halfway line, and it's like, hang on a second, why
like
the schedule? Yeah, why did they schedule a seagull business meeting at Eden Park during the Rugby World Cup final? Could they not have thought about this a little bit more?
Were they hoping the fox would scare them off?
Yeah, maybe. Or the chicken.
But, like, I also have the word seagull invasion in all caps written on my notes.
Yeah, okay. I'm really glad
the best
for that
bit,
matching.
Seagull invasion, there you are.
Seagull
the
invasion
best bit,
block
right,
caps.
Is then when Menzel comes to take the kickoff, which obviously he takes off the tee, as was tradition at the time. He plays the ball on the floor, and he goes to take the kick, and it hits a seagull! Like, we get a seagull charge down! Like, a seagull charges down a kick in the World Cup final, where a chicken has already been on the pitch!
I'll tell you what, like, Fabio didn't get the ball when he was on. He was close to taking a kickoff, I'll give him that. And he got man of the match because he was excellent. Timothy did basically get the ball. This seagull, properly defensive animal.
Yeah. Just like the sheer pressure he puts on, the line speed he gets up off the ground, you know.
What's this
amazing
seagull
stuff. I mean, the obvious name is Stephen. Everyone does the Stephen Seagull joke. We're not doing that.
His name's David.
So another good name for a seagull is David. So it's David the Seagull. Cool.
Yeah. Just in case he comes up in man of the match. We've got to clear these things up. Because you never know. I know it's the World Cup final.
But there's so many of his mates. Like, so much subterfuge going on with that seagull, man.
Absolutely. So, France then kind of get the ball and fuck around in the New Zealand half.
Eric Schomp makes great carry after great carry in this period.
He does. There's a
he
point
carries
where he
so
catches
hard for the scariest man with no muscles.
He catches a high ball, and John Gallagher makes a World Cup final business decision and goes to absolutely floor the wrong man and gets decked. And it's not called for obstruction because Gallagher just runs in the wrong direction. And it's great. Schomp just then has a run into somebody and is just not willing to be tackled. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Laurier nearly scores.
Yeah, this I don't get at all. So Laurier, as I say, almost scores, takes an offload, darts through, looks like he's going to score, is kind of grabbed by the ankles and hoisted down a yard short. Yeah. And he could have reached out and scored. He doesn't. Instead, he goes to present it back to Bebezier, who's running through. But before he can do that, the referee calls a penalty for New Zealand. And the reason given is tackle ball. I don't know if he means double movement, but that isn't a thing. Does he think he's playing rugby league and he's not allowed to play after he's been tackled?
Did he tackle the ball? Oh, wait. Maybe it was the obstruction from two phases earlier. That wasn't an obstruction.
I don't think so. I don't know. Yeah.
That's baffling.
It's a tackle ball. What's a tackle ball? I have no idea. I went back and watched this over and over again, and I can't see anything wrong with it. The only argument you can make is double movement when he hasn't had a proper look at it, but like he is just trying to present the ball back. That is fine. Or offload it. And he could have reached out and scored, and he probably should have reached out and scored.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, yeah, I'm past my 20 years of... Look, it's 20 years on, I'm allowed to complain about the referee. Kiwis can start complaining about that four pass to Wayne Barnes in 5 years' time. I bet you can't wait.
Exactly. Yeah, so Bebezier scores, and it's bloody well deserved.
Well, hold on. They do a really nice move, a really good move before this, from a penalty they get shortly afterwards.
Oh, yeah?
Where they set up, they have all 15 players in motion. It's great. They do a wall move. They tap it, and then the other 13 players all rush forward at the same time, running different lines. But the move they're actually running, right, if you ignore all of the pointless subterfuge, is pass the 12, who passes the 13's face. He just chucks it at his teammate's face.
So basically, like, they thought give it to Charvet Philip Seller would work while everyone's in their face.
Yeah. Denny Charvet thinks this is my big moment. This is the moment where I become a movie star. I'm going to chuck it at our best player's face. And if no one can see that, then they'll look at me instead. Just throws it plainly at Seller's face, who doesn't knock it on. It comes off his face, but it's given as a knock on. Eventually, France recover it. And as you say, this leads eventually to the score.
You will say, though, like, if Charvet chucked that pass properly and Seller scored, and then he got roles in all the big movies, Charvet would have been pissed. So
he would have been. He really would have been.
But yes, Bebezier scores. Very well-deserved try for him, and for France generally. Yeah. They kind of just drive up a few times and break down the defence.
Champs, of course. Yeah, another drive. Then Maynel drives himself as crash ball 10, which is lovely, of course. Of course he does. Yeah. That's what he does. And somehow gets an offload away to Bebezier, who just goes, all right, there's no defenders here. Scores under the post.
Yeah.
Does that sum it up?
Yes, I would say it does. And Canberra Barrow knocks over the conversion. Full-time whistle goes.
And at which point, yeah. And pandemonium begins. The 29-9. As Earl Curtin says, I've never seen the All Blacks show so much emotion at the end of a game.
Mm.
And the commentator says that Keith Quinn says he's never heard a noise so loud in any stadium he's ever been in to commentate or watch as a fan.
Eden Parker erupts.
And that was the general take. Yeah. Around, and the whole of New Zealand erupts. There's everything we were saying earlier about like the way they'd really connected with this nation over the course of this tournament.
Yeah.
And you just feel like New Zealand then completely, completely bursts.
Mm. Yeah. And it's really interesting because kind of for the minute or two after the final whistle goes, the All Blacks are leaping up and down. And it's weird because there's then a pitch invasion and the All Blacks want to celebrate together as much as there is the whole thing of togetherness with the nation. And there's this weird kind of like moment where it's just they're like, wait, what do we do? We just kind of want to celebrate here. And they kind of have to run past some security guards and then keep bouncing up and down together. France don't seem too disheartened about losing because I think they knew it was a foregone conclusion a long time out and they're actually quite proud of themselves, as they should be. And New Zealand then get that, as you say, like, for the first few minutes after that happens, they're loving it, you know, and the crowd are absolutely going wild. I can't tell if it's the way that this is edited, because it's on the World Rugby official feed, or what.
Yes.
But it feels like the time between the final whistle going and them heading into the tunnel up there and David Kirk lifting the trophy goes like that. It's so quick.
Oh, there's a very clear cut. They cut. They cut some time out. Yeah, yeah.
Because I have written down,
like pundits talking or whatever, but
okay, yeah, I have written down that the All Blacks look fairly happy about the fact they're about to lift the Webb Ellis Cup. But I think that's just because it's sunk in a little bit and it's cut.
Keith Curtin would be a great name. That's my stripper name. So Earl Curtin says that he's never seen the All Blacks show so much emotion, and there is not that much emotion being shown. They're all like, yay.
Yeah, they've all got to head into the stands. Nice. Mm.
Yeah, because they can't do the presentation on the pitch because there's a pitch inversion and everything is out there, so they can't just bring the stuff
and
out.
And there's chickens there and all sorts, yeah.
Bloody chickens. So many seagulls, chickens, the whole lot. Like,
there's a chicken inside the Webb Ellis Cup.
It's a nightmare.
Yeah.
Probably six dogs. You know, just a whole fleet of them. They have to all go into the tunnel. They have to, like, walk upstairs, come round, like, into a different bit of the stadium, and then come out. Like, it's such a long period of them kind of walking around. There's, like, a lot of admin involved in getting up to take the trophy. But eventually they walk up, they're all kind of queued up there, they send David Kirk out to go and lift the trophy. And it is... The moment you see it, like, A, the cameras they're using for David Kirk lifting the cup are clearly a far higher quality than the ones filming the match, which I think adds to it, but seeing him lift the World Cup is just instantly iconic as anything. You know, it's just, it clicks, and you kind of go, you can imagine watching that in 1987 going, I can't wait to see this again. You know, I can't wait to see more of this.
Yeah, and David Kirk obviously is beaming, and he's delighted. He's the first ever Rugby World Cup winning captain. It's a really, really iconic moment where the New Zealand public are all witnessing history. Delighted for David Kirk, first and foremost, that he's come in as captain and has done so brilliantly and lifted the Webb Ellis Cup. It's a fantastic moment.
Yeah. He said his message at halftime was just do the work. That was the thing he just kept saying over and over again, was do the work. And it's before coaches can send messages on or say anything.
Mm.
And I think it does kind of, in some ways, sum that second half up. Like, it is very, like, hashtag humble, hashtag group values or whatever.
Yes.
But there's something about the fact that, like, as he said, like, I didn't want us to play with flair. I wanted us to do the work.
Yeah,
and you can kind of see there's something about that kind of, like, very down-to-earth nature in the team that is embodied by David Kirk and how delighted he looks to be lifting the trophy. Like, it's not like the roar of determination and pride that, like, Martin Johnson or Steve
Lisi have
when they lift the trophy. Like, he is proud and excited and ecstatic and delighted.
Yes, yeah. But there's no real drama to the conclusion of it, of him lifting the trophy, is there? I don't know if that's because the commentators are extremely laid back about, like, oh, and there's David Kirk, he's lifting the trophy. That's nice. Or because David Kirk is just generally quite a wholesome being, as it turns out. But yeah, there's no real drama. Kind of like, you're right, the Martin Johnson roar of emotion is kind of the most iconic. Or Sir Khaleesi, I suppose.
Mm.
David Kirk is just very pleased to be there. And they ask him to say a few words afterwards. And it is the most polite post-match speech I have ever heard. Where he just says thanks.
It's very clearly written. Yeah.
Yes.
It's clearly something he's written and practiced in the mirror beforehand as well.
Yeah, and he sort of says thanks to, as I say, the squad. He said thank you to France as well for being such a fantastic opposition, which was very nice.
Got a big round of applause for that, for being a polite boy.
Yeah. Said thank you to the coaches. And then thank you to you, New Zealand. It would have been a lot harder without you, is what he says.
And he's beaming so broadly that you really you really believe that. Like, I've seen so many captains down the years say, like, thanks to the fans, whatever, and that's standard. David Kirk, I believe it more than ever. That
definitely
ends there.
He loved it. He had a great time.
Yeah.
And that's what Rugby World Cup Falls are about. Having a great time.
It very cleanly. Yeah. No ums and ahs. Like a great actor like Denis Charvet would one day go on to be.
Exactly.
His great varied career in films such as Viva La France, playing rugby hooligan. It's just very clean, very smooth. At no point does he thank the pigeon he saw outside his window this morning that he got to have a wank over.
Exactly.
None of that
happens.
What
a humble man.
What a humble man. What a kind of great encapsulation of this All Black team.
Exactly, exactly. And All Black teams to come, you know. Like, that's definitely foreshadowing them doing weird things of them passing suitcases in stupid ways on the way into a hotel.
Yeah, yeah.
It all happens because of David Kirk. Being so
polite
and nice.
Do you think this All Black team is a hangover on modern teams?
Instinctively, I want to say no, but I'm not really sure how to back that up.
I don't think it is, but I think it is in the background of an awful lot. I think there's a lot of things about All Black rugby that begin here.
Yeah, I guess so. The fact that they win the first World Cup, I suppose, is probably a thing of establishing dominance.
Yeah, but it's also, there's something in the kind of like the humble down-to-earth nature that sits on it. There's something in, as you say, that being the best team. And there's something in having players like John Kirwan and Grant Fox and Michael Jones.
Yeah, who are purely
dominant. And Patrick even.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think there's, as well as the innovation, the smaller innovations that we talked about in terms of the pod stuff and everything else, I think there is something interesting as a turning point in the All Blacks, which is very much his.
Yes.
And I think we're in an interesting place where they need that to happen in about 5 years' time. Like, not now, but they're going to need that to happen again soon. Because they're coming towards a kind of similar point to where they were at the early 80s at the minute. For the first time since then.
It's quite fascinating, actually, because we've covered the first World Cup the All Blacks win, the second World Cup the All Blacks win. Mm. We've not covered the five World Cups in between. So it would be really interesting, kind of the timeline of that and the growth, the ups and the downs of the All Blacks, the rise and the fall. So that will be quite interesting as we kind of go on through the World Cups in the 90s and so on and so forth.
Yeah, absolutely. And in terms of France, I don't think this sets any precedent at all. I think France is just France.
Yeah, France, it's a very French team, and we've had a lot of them since.
Yeah. It's an important moment in All Black rugby, genuinely. Mm. I think it's just a France moment in French rugby.
Yeah, I don't think they were too surprised that they lost the game.
No.
But that's not to say that they thought they were going to. I think they put up a genuine fight. Yeah. They've been brilliant all tournament, and they were very much deserving finalists.
Yes. And I think it was a fantastic game to cap things off.
Yeah.
Shall we do very, very quick leaving parties for France and New Zealand?
No.
Okay. No, okay. Let's nominate a player of the tournament for either nation, as we're doing in keeping. So, France, okay. I think Philippe Seller, if I'm picking one, gun to my head.
Yeah, agreed. Philippe Seller, easily. He's just bloody world class.
And New Zealand, it is Grant Fox or John Kerwin. And today, I'm going to say John Kerwin, but it could be Grant Fox.
I would say Fox. Yeah.
Yeah, we split the difference. There we are, Grant. Okay.
Yeah.
So, now, dick of the man and day of the day.
I feel like...
We did it. We got through the bloody World Cup final, didn't we?
Oh, we did.
There we are. Good work. We got through all of them.
Yeah. I think with Man of the Match and Dick of the Day, to say... I think we should end the World Cup final with Man of the Match. I think we should do Dick of the Day first. So,
I agree.
One man I have written down is Alan Wetton for not scoring. It's like, mate, you do it in every other game.
Fair enough.
And don't do it in the final, bottler. One man is Daniel De Bronca because he was just being a dick all day. And all power to him. But
absolutely.
The dick of the day, for me, is the guy who tries to trip at the chicken.
Yes, the chicken tripper.
Yeah, the chicken did a great job of escaping him, though, so it was all fine. Guy looked like a dick, so, yeah, he's my dick of the day.
Yeah. You know what? I think that's a very, very good shout. I do want to mention Serge Blanco, so that David Kirk try comes from Serge Blanco not calling the mark in the 22.
Oh, you're right.
When he's under enormous pressure. And I think that is
It's a howler in a World Cup final, yeah.
Yeah.
From a world-class player
as well. I think they probably would have lost the game anyway, but it's a big turning point. It's a big swing, him doing that.
It's a valid point.
So I think that's a real dick of the day possibility moment.
Yeah.
And otherwise, though, I think it's actually quite a hard game to pick a dick of the day for.
It is.
Because
I
think it is a game in which virtually everyone stands up and plays well. Like, yes, I can nominate Blanco for that moment, but like he plays really well otherwise.
He does. And he does.
I don't think there's a kind of weak link in either team. It's a properly great World Cup final. But that said, my dick of the day is Kerry Fitzgerald, the referee, who so glad it's 20 years on, because he was a prick.
Yeah, fair enough.
At least he refereed like a prick.
Yeah,
at least
fair
I don't know
play.
Him personally.
Fair play.
So my dick of the day, Kerry Fitzgerald, the referee, for blowing 800 uncontestable balls when they were playable. Grumble.
Entirely fair. For man of the match, I have a few written down. So,
yes,
obviously, I have written down Jean Chicken, the chicken, who runs on the start of the pitch. I have to have him written down. Unfortunately, there are two factors why he doesn't win it. One of them being the fact it's a World Cup final is kind of a bit of a bullshit thing to give man of the match to a chicken.
To a chicken.
The second one is resemblance to Feathers McGraw, who I fucking despise. Right?
That's true. He is the same species.
He's the same species as Feathers McGraw. And look, I know that's not Jean's fault, but I could never give Man of the Match to somebody who could feasibly be a relative of Feathers.
Okay. It is why I won't give Man of the Match to any of the players in this game, because they are all the same species as Paddy Jackson.
Oh, yeah, I guess so. who is arguably maybe even worse.
That was
than
a
Fevers.
Less funny example to bring up. Yeah. There's an argument to be made. Why isn't Fevers McGraw signed for London Irish yet?
Yeah.
He seems right up their street.
Anyway.
Maybe he has, and he's just wearing a different hat.
Maybe he's Nick Phipps. Yeah. Both land on the same player. That can't be a coincidence. Speaking of scrum halves, I have Pierre Bebezier. I think he's France's best player in this game. Mm. I think he's fantastic in defence and in attack. But man of the match I landed on was David Kirk. I think he kicks brilliantly.
Okay.
I think he takes his try really well.
I like
He leads the team well. And I just think he stood up when he absolutely needed to. And I think this is by a long way his best game in the World Cup. And it was exactly the performance that was asked of a captain in the first ever World Cup final. Yeah. And I think David Kirk was fantastic. So he's my man of the match.
You know what? I kind of agree with that. I think this is his best game of the tournament. I think he is brilliant. And I was completely in agreement with that. And you'll slowly swing me round. I think the best player on the field is Eric Schomp. I think he has the best game by any forward in this tournament.
Oh, that's a big call.
It is the most impressed I have been by a forward in this tournament overall across the whole thing. I think he's absolutely
great.
Immense. And we've talked about him a bit.
Yeah.
But
proper
the
nuisance,
sheer work
great
he
ball
puts
carrier.
In.
Yeah.
Those moments, like, he makes a few huge carries. He makes one really lovely pass, which is really unlike him. But there are so many little moments of him just, like, getting in amongst the All Blacks. And, like, the moment that really stood out to me of him smashing Buck Shelford, who looked like he was going to score into touch. And beats like that, like him really getting in Grant Fox's face at one point. Him putting John Kerwin into touch when he's got a bit of space. I just thought he was absolutely everywhere. And I don't know what it is about number six is playing for France in World Cup finals. But There's something about them. There's something about them. I can't wait to watch 1999 and suddenly, you know, pick up whoever's at six for France that day. I think he's
so.
The
is
best
he your man
field.
Of the match?
I'm really tempted to give it to him, but I think Michael Jones is right up there with him. I think Michael
he's
Jones has
bloody
a
good.
Game.
Yeah,
and I also think though Grant Fox and David Kirk are both outstanding.
Mm.
But I think if I'm completely honest, right, and it doesn't really reflect the thing, but I think the best performance on the day was Eric Schomp, and I've done enough joke contenders or I've kind of like swung around or just given it to someone that scored tries and so on in this tournament, right? That I kind of want to give it to the guy that I genuinely do think played best.
I applaud
in the
that.
Final.
I applaud
and
that.
And I'm going to say my man of the match for the 1987 Rugby World Cup final. If I was on commentary and awarding an official man of the match, I probably would have agreed if you'd gone for David Kirk. But in the format of this podcast where you've already given him one, I'm going to concede a bit, and also because I've gone second,
respect.
So I don't need to give it to David Kirk, and give it to Eric Schomp, the French
respect.
Flanker.
Fair play.
Who
fair play.
Also,
great game.
Him, Rodriguez, and Laureau, the second row, were known in France as the three giraffes.
The giraffes, yes.
So there's a little
we
bit
did
of tribute for you.
This.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, that
wow,
almost three-hour podcast, the longest we've done by some distance.
I think there's a chance this is going to get split in two.
We'll see. Brings down the curtain on the 1987 Rugby World Cup series.
Wow.
Thank you
so
much for listening. Yeah.
Thank you so much. This has been bizarre that anyone would listen to us talk about this. So thank
you
so much.
It's been unbelievably niche.
The whole time. Yes.
This has been one of the most niche pieces of rugby content ever put out. And
genuinely, yes.
The fact that people have listened and enjoyed it.
Thanks anyone who's played along with the joke.
Thank
you. Yeah.
Yeah, anyone that's got through the end of a three-hour episode on a game from 35 years ago, you are magical people. Thank you.
The good news is we're going to carry on talking about it to wrap it up in the next episode.
Yes. So, please, join us again very soon. We'll be back next week, presumably, to wrap up the World Cup, go for our players of the tournament, our team in the tournament, all of that, work through the whole thing. We'll put a poll on Twitter for your player of the tournament to get your votes and etc. And then beyond that, we've also got something exciting new that we want to do, where we're going to do a draft team between the 1987 and 2011 tournaments.
Hell
we're
yeah.
We're going to roll through that and slowly pick squads that we'll put against each other and pick for kind of votes and see.
So that'll
who
get its own episode.
Better dream team.
Yes.
Yes.
I'm
that'll
so excited.
That'll come after that. So am I. We're going to pull them between them and we'll add to one after each World Cup we finish. We'll then add another episode looking at the draft and adding to our teams and building our squads out, our dream Rugby World Cup squads out, which I think so is quite good. An exciting thing that we'll be slowly building up.
Mm-hmm.
So that brings us to the end of 1987. But beyond this, we will be moving on to another World Cup.
Oh, are you going to announce it? I'm going to say which one we're going to do.
We will be moving on after this, after those next two episodes, wrapping this up, to, after probably a quite short break, looking at the 2007 Rugby World Cup.
How exciting is that? It's the last World Cup before we got into rugby. That's so cool.
Yeah.
The players that we were like learning at the time. I'm so excited to get into 2007.
There's a level of like, because I remember the 2007 Rugby World Cup, what happening? I remember watching like a couple of games, but I wasn't as invested in the way I was by 2011.
Yeah, like you didn't
you
care.
Know, like I was kind of, yeah, I was aware of it and I watched a few games. I remember the final, I remember one of Wales' games, I don't remember which one. And I remember like bits of that, but like it's not one I know inside out. And so there's a lot to learn,
yes.
Even though obviously you pick up a lot through, you know, rugby osmosis and learning and studying it and it being my job and so on. So I'm really excited about that. Also, obviously, with the fact that this World Cup that we've covered in 87 was a mirror of the first World Cup we covered in 2011.
Indeed.
Which we covered for kind of like partly nostalgic reasons, partly kind of like interesting to see how the game had changed in 10 years because we're doing, you know, 10 year anniversary of that happening. We are obviously looking at 2007 because it's a direct parallel to what's happening next year in 2023 when the World Cup returns to France.
It's going to be great before we go to that World Cup to have the knowledge of what happened the previous time it was hosted there. It's going to be so good.
Yeah. So the plan is we will be covering every single game from the 1980... No, from... We've already done that. Oh, shit.
You've done that.
I can't get out of the habit. From the 2007 Rugby World Cup coming up on this podcast very soon. Hopefully more of you see that as relevant because there's more crossover. But I hope you've enjoyed what we've done on 1987. We've tried to be fairly comprehensive. I still feel like, as I said, we've got stuff left on the table, but that's grand. I feel like I've learned an awful lot. I've experienced a lot. I've lived a lot. I've loved a lot. And I've hated even more.
I've felt a lot.
But mostly, I've certainly felt a lot. How do you feel now this is over?
Fine.
Yeah, fair enough. But if there's one thing I've taken away from this tournament, one thing I think we've both taken away from this tournament is a love of one particular phenomenon. So I think there can only be three words that can possibly end this series of the podcast, that can possibly end this mammoth, almost three-hour episode on the 1987 Rugby World Cup final. Why did we do this? How does anyone let us get away with this and continue listening? Cool. Thank you for doing so, though. And so, I think, to play us out, as began the tournament, in the very first game, a phenomenon we fell deeply in love with and has become a core part of the podcast identity since, I think, and forever will be going forward when we cover future World Cups. I think there's only three words we can possibly end this on. And I haven't discussed this with Will, but I believe you are agreed on the same three words.
Indeed.
And so, it is time for us to say goodbye, good night, see you very soon. See you very much, I was going to say. See you very much. But more importantly,
Dog on the pitch! Thank you. Good night.
Good night.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.